So apart from the rules for children that are listed on the refrigerator, families are not governed by highly structured, law-like, formalized relationships. They're more immediate and informal. And over against the family, however, stands society, civil society, which is not as informal. There are more formal, organized, and structured relationships within civil society. Here we conceive of our relationship to our neighbors and so forth as a social compact between autonomous individuals. I have my freedom, but you have your freedom, and we've come to an agreement how we're going to respect one another's freedom in society. So you have the family on one side, informal, unstructured. You have civil society that is more formal and structured. That tension, in terms of what our concept of social freedom is, that tension is synthesized and transcended in the state. According to Hegel, we come to realize our immediate personal needs, that is, as we feel them in the family, are really better fulfilled through something that's organized and structured in its relationships, like civil society. And so the state becomes our true self. Yes? Not this part. What philosophers throw out, many as hogwash or vague abstractions and so forth, is the portion we looked at before, the development of absolute spirit and all that. But this social theory has been endorsed by a number of people. In fact, what Hegel is saying here is a reflection of Rousseau's philosophy, as a matter of fact. But, of course, he had to reach those conclusions not in the way that Rousseau did, through his kind of immediate romantic experience, you know, of nature and man's freedom and so forth. But he did it in a dialectical fashion. So he said, now, what is your understanding of freedom? Okay, well, freedom begins psychologically with a sense of personality. But then I have to understand there are other spirits or minds out there, and they have freedom and personality. That leads me to objective spirit and a discussion of freedom at the level of property rights. And you've seen how we've done this dialectical dance back and forth. We have property rights, but then personality can be divided, so that leads us to ethics and motivation, and these are resolved, you know, and then we go on. And so Hegel has developed it in his own way, but what Hegel is saying here has been endorsed by many people. In fact, it's a prevailing continental view of politics, where the individual's freedom is most fully realized, and your good, even though you may not realize it, is more fully realized in the state. The state is the synthesis that transcends the informality of the family and the structured relationships of society. And we come to realize that our personal needs are better fulfilled through the state than from simply having our property rights respected. But now we have to go a step further in Hegel's thinking. Since he was congenial to the Prussia of his own day, don't forget that Prussia had officially endorsed the philosophy of Hegel. Since Hegel was congenial to the Prussian monarchy, he idealized the Prussian monarchy as the model of the true state. Okay, so let's see if we can put all this together. You as a spirit, as a mind, as a consciousness, experience freedom. But if you rationally think about it, your freedom is best realized and your good maximized, not by being a separate individual, but by being part organically of the state, the whole of human mind or consciousness. And the state that Hegel was thinking of when he said the state is the best place for human freedom to be maximized, the state is idealized according to the model of the Prussian monarchy. Will? No, there is no right to be left alone in terms of your highest good. Your freedom is best maximized. I've just proven this rationally to you, Will. I don't understand why you continue to question it. Well, I know why you continue to question it, and that's because you don't share the presuppositions of Hegel. But he has basically rationalized his presuppositions. That pun is intended. He has used reason to show that ultimately individual freedom is found in the state, not freedom over against the state, but freedom within the state and subordination to it. He's used reason to do that, so he's rationalized his presuppositions. You don't share those presuppositions, but anyway, so there is no right to be left alone. Your freedom, see, you call freedom the right to be left alone. And he would say that's very vague, low-level self-consciousness. If you analyze the concept of freedom, you would be led to see that your true freedom is found in the state. Was there another hand? Mike? Well, the concrete individual, in terms of social theory, is found in the state. Because the state is very individual, it's very concrete, but it's also universal. It encompasses all the minds or self-consciousnesses out there. And so he would think that he fit into this pattern, giving a concrete universal. Anyway, the point I was making is that the Prussian monarchy was seen by Hegel then as the grand climax of world history. Is Hegel being consistent with his own philosophy? See, I can criticize him from outside. I've got plenty, like Will, I don't agree with his concept of freedom, and I don't think he's rationally proven it, but at least I can see how he gets there. I know what he's doing. But from within his system, there's a problem here too. To be consistent with his philosophy, it seems to me he should not have chosen a localized state as the final culmination of freedom, should he? It shouldn't have been a local state, it should have been what? The world community as a whole. He should have wanted a universal state. And it couldn't have been just one local state in the course of history, the Prussian monarchy. That could only be a stage along the way, couldn't it? And so here's the rationalist wanting to show necessary connections, and as I like to say when I teach apologetics, scratch a rationalist, you'll find an arbitrary man. The arbitrariness of this rationalism is conspicuous when you finally flesh it out in social theory. The Prussian monarchy is the climax. Well, your own philosophy should tell you that can't be the climax. One, because it's local, not universal. And secondly, because it's only one stage in historical development. Okay, what I want you to get from this discussion, and I want to talk about it just for a few more minutes here, is Hegel's organic view of the state. His organic view of the state. Hegel said that individual citizens are like organs of a body of which they are the parts. Individual citizens are like organs of a body of which they are the parts, and that the true individual would not be the parts of the body, the organs of the body. The true individual would be the whole of the body. So the true individual that experiences freedom would be the state. Individual citizens lose their independence in the unity, then, of the state. For them to truly understand freedom, they give up their independence for the sake of the true individual, that's the state. And that's understandable. They're just organs of the body. And if you're an organ of the body, it's to your interest, what? To go along with the whole body. An eye is not going to do real well without a heart. Okay? Cut off the blood supply, and what happens to eyes? They go blind. So here's this I that says, I want to be free. I want to be left alone, to use Will's terms. And so you heart, you leave me alone. The heart goes, great, you're cut off. You're all on your own now. What happens to the I? Is the I free? No, now the I is dead. I doesn't see anything. And so the I has lost its freedom in its attempt to be free. Isn't that an irony? Well, some people would say it's a false analogy. But if that is your underlying presupposition, the organic view of the state, then you can understand this is the implication. This is what you'd carry out. Now, before you as Christians get too critical of Hegel's view of the state, does this sound familiar to you? Can the eye say to the hand? No, it comes right out of the Bible, doesn't it? Does the Bible view the state as an organic unity? No, the analogy here used by Paul is of what? The church. Okay? And so, what... Thank you. You're being very good students. I love it when you can anticipate my next sentence. That's exactly right. And so we have to be real careful because, in a sense, Hegel has made out of the state a church. I mean, given our view. He doesn't see it that way, but what we think is appropriate to the church, he's transferred to the state. Individual citizens lose their independence in the unity of the state. That's where we were. And therefore, according to Hegel, individuals ought to identify their interest with that of the state, and in doing so, they do it for their own good. If they do not identify their interest with that of the state, they must be forced to do so. Let me say that again. If individual citizens will not identify their interest with that of the state as fulfilling their true good, then they must be forced to do so. Now, given our American perspective, our individual rights perspective, that horrifies us. But you must remember, I mean, it horrifies me too, and I'm not going to leave that horror, but you have to understand Hegel sympathetically. What he was saying is, it's for your good to be forced to identify with the state. You may not realize it's in your best interest, but it's for your good that the state does this. Now, that sounds like another social institution, doesn't it? Here, not the church. But in what social institution do we have one person saying to another person, you may not like it, but it's for your good? That's what fathers say to their children, and mothers as well. But this is where we get the term paternalism. Paternalism is acting like a father toward someone. And when the state acts in a paternalistic way, it's saying, you may not think you should have to be in by midnight, but it's for your own good. And so I will force you to do what is in your own good. That's a paternalistic attitude. And so, interestingly, Hegel has the state acting like or being conceived of as the church and as a father to us all. Paternalistic and ecclesiastical ways of thinking applied to the state. Now, I tend to think, those of you who know my theology and philosophy, that you have to distinguish these institutions of society. The family, the church, and the state are not the same. They have different operating rules and purposes. But now Hegel would say, isn't that just typical of you? Because you approach things in terms of distinctions, I approach things in terms of what? The unity of all things. And so I'm not bothered by the fact that what you call the family and the church, I've applied to the state, because it's all on a continuum for me. For you, you draw sharp distinctions. In Hegel's organic view of the state, where people are forced to do what is in their best interest, we see reflected, remember, Rousseau's doctrine of the general will. To review for you, the general will in Rousseau stands over against the will of all. Those are two different expressions. The will of all is simply what each individual might want to do is in his best interest. Okay. So if we were to take a vote here of all the individuals in this class about what we should eat for lunch, you would all vote for what's in your own, you know, personal interest. And if we combine them, you know, and we got, okay, the majority say that we should have pizza for lunch, not, you know, Mexican food, that would be the will of all, okay? But if everybody were to choose what we're to eat for lunch with the concept of what's best for the entire class, then you would have the general will of the class. The general will considers what is best for the whole society. It's what everybody really wants then, whether they realize it or not. So if everybody were to vote for what we'll have for lunch, and it came out that the majority want pizza, the minority may not realize it, but that really is what they want, is pizza, because that's in their best interest, whether they realize it or not. And we would say to the minority, you're not going to go over to Taco Bell and eat. You're going to be forced to go to Pizza Hut with us. You will be compelled to go along with the majority, and in so doing, you will be compelled to be free. Yeah, that is the expression from Rousseau that ought to just send off the flares in your thinking. Compelled to be free. Your freedom, paradoxically, is found in compulsion to be subordinate to the general will. And this is what Hegel believed. Hegel believed that individual citizens have their good maximized by subordinating their individuality to the state. And if they will not subordinate their individuality to the state, they'll be forced to. For their good. For their good. What is the false assumption here? I mean, you don't have to have advanced courses in logic and philosophy to see this. The false assumption is that the majority always chooses what's in the best interest of the society as a whole. Not only is that a false assumption just in general, but from what we know in terms of concrete facts of history, it is absolutely preposterous that somebody could have a philosophy that says, well, but the general will really is what's in the best interest of everybody. Yeah, right. But this was, I mean, Hegel was so committed to these presuppositions. Hey, the facts be hung. You haven't understood the facts right. Because my philosophy is rational. So if you understand history correctly, rationally, scientifically, which is to say in a Hegelian way, then the facts can't contradict what I'm saying here. Well, of course, I'm sticking with the facts, thank you. I don't think the majority is always choosing what's in the best interest of society as a whole. I mean, just look at our current state, miserable state of politics in America right now at the late 20th century. Do you seriously think that the vast majority of people, when they go to the polls, vote on the basis of what they think is in the best interest of the total society? Ha! Wake up and smell the coffee. Most people vote on the basis of what is going to be what? Good for them. So if you have a candidate, if you're a member of a labor union, you have a candidate that's going to help the labor unions, you vote for that guy. Even if his policies are going to do general damage to the economic well-being of the society. People do not vote, usually, with an interest for, I mean, they should. Christians should, but it's a hard thing to do. And Hegel just blithely took it for granted that the majority will actually choose what's in the best interest of everybody as a whole. Like Rousseau, Hegel saw the compulsion of the individual or the compulsion of minority parties in the state as really just inducing people to choose what they really want instead of what they mistakenly believe they want. You really want freedom. You really want, therefore, what the state dictates to you. So a citizen's true will is what the state wants for him. That's his true good, since he's only part of, he's an organ of, the larger whole of the state. And then a final remark about his socio-political view. In light of the progress of history, remember that for Hegel, the individual passes through several objective phases, the family, the society, the state. And in each one of those phases, within the family, within society, and within the state, we see a movement from subjectivity to objectivity, from partiality to unity and universality. Human history, in the most general sense, is a progressive move then from bondage to freedom, the bondage of partiality to universality, from the bondage of subjectivity to objectivity. This freedom is achieved only as the partial and incomplete desires of the one are overcome and integrated into the unified system of the state, in which the will of the one citizen is replaced by the will of all. And thus, Hegel held to the priority of the state and rejected individualism as he had seen it come to expression in the American War of Independence and the French Revolution. Remember Hegel's dates. Hegel looked upon the War of Independence in America and the French Revolution a decade or so later with horror. He said, the state is prior to individualism, has a greater priority or importance. For Hegel, individualism actually runs contrary to the nature of humanity. It runs contrary to the nature of reality as a whole, because the individual has value only as part of the greater unified whole. As a matter of history of philosophy, you need to realize from this point on, though, the disciples of Hegel, and there was quite a cult of Hegel in his lifetime, toward the end of his life, and then beyond for almost a century. The cult of Hegel divided, though, into what are now called left-wing or radical Hegelians and right-wing Hegelians. And I'll expect you to show me that you understand this when you write about it on your test. Left-wing or radical Hegelians believe that history, the progress of history, culminates in the revolutionary triumph of the working class. Make my day. Who then is the leading light or representation of the left-wing Hegelian outlook? Karl Marx, right. The right-wing Hegelians, on the other hand, tended to stress the necessity of a unified state, and they stress the kind of status quo statism that is connected with conservative politics in most countries. Conservative in the sense that it's not revolutionary. The state still has the priority, but it's the state as is, kind of like a traditionalism, rather than the state as it comes about through revolutionary anarchy. So you need to know that Hegel's grand rational system is subject to two interpretations, the right-hand and the left-hand interpretations. Something of an irony, but some people would say that if Hegel were here, he could tell us which of those two is really, you know, true to his intention. Yes? The left wing? Left wing Hegelians believe that the culmination of history is found in the revolutionary triumph of the working class over the landed aristocracy. Basically, left wing Hegelianism is revolutionary thought. And Karl Marx, of course, is the leading example of that. Well, let's see if we can summarize Hegel, and then I'd like to have my say in criticizing him. I've criticized him along the way, but you ain't seen nothing yet. Okay. By way of summary, I'm going to give you a statement here that I want you to have in your notes. I'm going to dictate it to you. This is for those lonely nights of despair when you are saying, I can't understand Hegel. What did he mean by this? You can come to this statement as kind of your touchstone. oh, thank you, Dr. Bonson, for giving us in one simple statement what it's all about. Here it is. You ready? Here's Hegel's philosophy, boiled down. The culmination of the dialectical process of development through conflict. The expression development through conflict is a hyphenated one. The culmination of the dialectical process of development through conflict in history and thought, underline and, in history and thought is one, the resolution of all contradictions, and two, I'm going to repeat, so don't worry, the identification of thought and reality in the absolute. The culmination of the dialectical process of development through conflict in history and thought is one, the resolution of all contradictions, and two, the identification of thought and reality in the absolute. And then parenthetically, which was implicitly present in earlier stages. Which was implicitly present in earlier stages. Let me give it to you one more time. The culmination of the dialectical process of development through conflict in history and thought is the resolution of all contradictions and the identification of thought and reality in the absolute, which was implicitly present in earlier stages. You have to admit, that's pretty good, eh? Kind of boils it down nicely. Here's the interesting thing. Talk about development of consciousness. If I had started my lecture on Hegel yesterday with that very nice summary of Hegel, you would have gone, huh? But now you understand it. You say, yeah, I understand that. There's a process that's going to culminate. It's a process that's dialectical. Development comes about through conflict. And that process is part of history and part of reasoning. And the culmination will resolve all those contradictions, and thought and reality will become identified in the absolute. This absolute was implicitly present in all the stages that it finally culminates into. There's Hegel. Now, didn't I tell you yesterday I could make this at least somewhat understandable to you? Some of the main themes, again, I'm just summarizing now, but you may find this more helpful even than the lecture. Some of the main themes, the real is the rational. Hegel emphasizes reason. He's an absolute idealist. The real is the rational, and the truth is the whole. What is real is whatever is rational. And what is true is whatever is the whole of things. Another feature of Hegel, becoming, is a fundamental feature of reality. All of reality is characterized by becoming, evolution, development. Remember that later stages of history and reasoning were implicit in the earlier stages. The culmination of natural outworking and rational outworking is the absolute. And in the absolute, thought and nature, reason and nature, idea and its objects become one. All contradictions are resolved there. And thus, Hegel has a philosophy of history that says history is guided by the absolute. All history has implicit in it the absolute working itself out into self-consciousness, where thought and reality are the same. And the phenomena of history in nature and the phenomena of reasoning in our thinking process are but the externalizations of absolute spirit. Absolute spirit is working its way out in nature, working its way out in reasoning, and one day they'll be the same. But since the absolute is working its way out, and the culmination of history is the state, then what the state does is right. What is right. You want to write that down. So what is right, and that is represented by the will of the state. At the break, I mentioned to a few of you that I had been criticizing Hegel up to that point for either being confused or contrary to common sense or vague and arrogant. But if you put together this portion of my lecture, I hope what you see is I'm trying to say his philosophy is not harmless arrogance. It's not harmless pseudo-profundity. It's very dangerous. Because this rational system doesn't simply require you to see that what Hegel is saying is the Weltgeist working its way out through Hegel's philosophy. It also leads you to say, I've got to subordinate myself automatically to the state. Yeah. Yeah, I think you have to look at German history in light of absolute idealism. And not because you can draw a one-to-one correspondence that you can find a sentence in Hitler that he says, well, Hegel has taught me that, and so forth. But, I mean, if you stand back and look at the influence of ideas and philosophy and culture, in German culture, it's elsewhere too, but especially what we know from the history of two wars in the 20th century, German culture has worked out this idea that your true individuality is to get lockstep, pun intended, with the state. Sure does. And it justifies them. You have to understand, is it because of the way in which we have savaged Hitler in his genocide of the Jews, and he deserves to be savaged. It's a moral atrocity, no doubt about that. But the way in which we do it often portrays Hitler as though he just hated the Jews. You just have to understand, Hitler thought he was doing what was in the best interest of the German Republic. And that means everybody's freedom is being guarded, even while he's trampling on the freedom of the Jews. I realize it's a state of mind that's frightening, but it would be a misrepresentation to think Hitler just had this thing against Jews and so he tried to kill as many as he could. No, he thought that the state was ridding itself of an unwarranted element and that everybody would be better off for that. Of course, that makes the atrocity even the worse because it's done in the name of love. All tyrants do, by the way. Well, I won't say all, I can't generalize, but it seems that most tyrants do have some kind of motivation that covers for them the atrocity of what they're doing. Okay, so that's Hegel. You know the philosophical side and its application to socio-political theory. What I want to do in the remainder of this lecture is to take some time to criticize Hegel's philosophy. By way of criticism of Hegel's grand rational system of philosophy, I would first of all point out that I think, in a sense, Hegel's on the horns of a dilemma. On the horns of a dilemma. And that when you read what he has to say, it's going to come out one of two ways, and in both cases, it's not very flattering. Sometimes when you read Hegel, it comes out as basically pseudo-profound nonsense. Pseudo-profound nonsense. Where there is some truth in what Hegel is saying, it's a small truth that I think has been puffed up greatly. And that's why it's pseudo-profound. In my attempt to make Hegel understandable, of course, I've had to, in some way, argue for him and make it seem intelligible. So, along the way, I have said things to you, which I said, now you can understand that, can't you? You can understand this synthesis idea and how every truth, in one sense, is partial, and even false statements have a kind of truth to them, and so, bit by bit along the way, we've been able to understand. I mean, we even understand now that when I reflect upon myself as a thinking self, what I'm thinking about the object is really the subject that's thinking about itself as a thinking subject. And so I overcome the difference between subject and object. But when you get done with it, you say, that's such a small truth. It's such a trivial truth. And so it's pseudo-profound. Small truths puffed up. But in many cases, this pseudo-profundity is nonsensical. It's a matter of vague and very unclear intellectual pomposity. I'm pulling out all stops. I realize this is not a matter of professional courtesy now. I've tried to be courteous to Hegel. I've tried to explain him, but I have to admit much of this is intellectual pomposity, I think. It's vague and it's unclear. And for that reason, Hegel is found to be very difficult to understand. And given that difficulty, he's subject to conflicting interpretations. And that's not to flatter him. Whenever your philosophy is subject, apparently with legitimacy, to conflicting interpretations, you've not done a good job communicating. Maybe you haven't done a good job thinking through what you're trying to communicate either. So the first horn of the dilemma is that this appears to be pseudo-profound nonsense when you read it. Before I get to the second horn, what do we make of this difficulty to understand? How do people respond? I'm asking a psychological or a socio-psychological question. How do people tend to respond when the professor at the university gives these grand, eloquent lectures that are full of vocabulary that's unfamiliar and abstractions that tend to intimidate, and he seems to be very confident that he's put together this grand system. How do people respond? Well, just like the citizens in the story of the king who had no clothes, right? They go, oh boy, I'll tell you, the emperor is certainly decked out today. Isn't that wonderful? And no one likes the little kid, that Dr. Bonson in the story here, who's sitting on the curb saying, why'd the king come out here without his clothes on? He doesn't have any grand suit, you know, that ought to be respected here. But most people do not respond as the child. Most people are intimidated and they'll say, boy, if I don't understand this, it's probably because I'm kind of stupid. Hegel knew a lot more than I did. Well, this is a tricky thing in terms of being a faithful or trying to be a faithful professor to you. I don't want to teach you as young people to be arrogant. You have a lot to learn. No doubt about it. I do too. And so I don't want to say, well, anytime somebody says something you disagree with or doesn't seem quite right to you, you can just, you know, lay them low. But on the other hand, I don't want you to be intimidated by scholars. I don't want you to take the Hegels of this world and just say, wow, I guess I can't understand this. Yes, you can understand this. You may have to demand re-explanation, put it in other words. You may have to go home and think about it. You may have to research things, but don't take anybody's word for it. I don't care if they have a PhD in philosophy and have written all these books. Don't be intellectually bullied. This is life counsel for you, not just with respect to Hegel. I have tried hard to understand Hegel, and I have been willing to say Hegel was a much smarter man than I was. In many ways, he had insights I would not have come up with. I'm willing to admit that. But you put the whole system together, I'm telling you, first of all, it's pseudo-profound. The horns of the dilemma, though, that's only one horn. Sometimes when you read Hegel, it looks like pseudo-profound nonsense. But other times when you read Hegel, you can make sense out of it. And it's not pseudo-profound, and it's not vague, and it's not unclear. And when Hegel can be understood, and you can press beyond all the fog and so forth, and you finally get something very definite, the problem is what he says is contrary to common sense and indemonstrable. Okay, I understand what Hegel is saying now when he says thought and reality will become one. I understand that. Now what I want to know is, how on earth could he demonstrate that? That's just armchair speculation, isn't it? I also understand what he's getting at when he says that the individual's true freedom is preserved in subordination to the state. I understand what that sentence means. That's not the not nothings itself kind of vagary. But what he's saying here is absolutely contrary to common sense. And so you see the problem for Hegel, the horns of the dilemma. On the one hand, when you read him, it's pseudo-profound, vague stuff no one can make any sense out of, or just trivial truths puffed up. Or on the other hand, it's clear and it's understandable, but it's really obviously wrong, contrary to common sense. Or if not obviously wrong, it's something which is totally beyond the possibility of demonstration. It's utter speculation. So that's my first criticism, the horns of the dilemma. Do we have puffed up triviality here, pseudo-profundity, or do we have statements which can be understood and yet they're just contrary to good sense and beyond demonstration? Now, this horns of the dilemma criticism, as I put it to you, is kind of a criticism of Hegel from outside. Granted, I'm not a Hegelian, so I'm standing out here and I give it to you this way, and I haven't been, you know, real respectful of him. But on his own terms, let me be more sympathetic, get within his system. On his own terms, Hegel's exalted view of the status of his developed philosophical system would have to be called arbitrary dogmatism. Please understand, this is not my standing outside of him saying it. If you listen to Hegel, Hegel should never have exalted the status of his developed philosophical system. And when he did exalt it, that's nothing more but arbitrary dogmatism on his part. He inconsistently, from within his system, he inconsistently thought that the dialectical progress of reason culminated in his own system. But given what he taught us, it could not have culminated in his system. So there's an internal inconsistency in Hegel. Given his view of dialectical progress, where thought and reality are finally unified, his philosophy could not have been the culmination. My third criticism. The first one was the horns of the dilemma. The second is, within his own system, he's inconsistent to exalt the status of what he had developed. My third criticism is that Hegel's grand dialectical system is a project that failed. Now I'm looking at it just as a project. Here he laid out this plan, okay? And I'm saying, well, it's a failed one. And I see it as failing in three ways. First, he never completed it. At his death, he didn't work out all the grand details of all the accumulated data of the ages into a rational, necessary system of connections. Secondly, what he did finish, I've already told you this before, but what he did finish is unconvincing. So the project failed in that it was incomplete, and what was completed was unconvincing. And thirdly, ex hypothesi, that is from out of the hypothesis itself, the project could never be known to be terminated. You must write this criticism down very exactly so I can explain it. Ex hypothesi, from the hypothesis itself, the project could never, underline never, be known in quotation marks, or can never be known to be terminated. Can you beat me to the punchline here? Do you all understand why the project could never be known to be terminated? Well, according to the hypothesis, at the termination of the project, what do you have? Thought and reality are identical.
Couldn't think of that.
That's right. And if thought and reality are identical at the termination of the process, then you can't think about it being terminated. So in the nature of the case, if Hegel's system ever were terminated, you could never know that it was terminated, because knowing assumes a distinction between knower and the known, which is, by this hypothesis, ruled out at the termination. I want you to remember this, because this is a form of internal transcendental critique.